Welcome to Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast, the podcast that pulls back the curtain on the evolving world of sports science. I'm Andrew Rizza, an athlete trainer with decades of experience in professional, collegiate, and high school sports.
And I'm Cameron Roth, an orthopedic surgeon and a consultant for the Chicago White Sox.
In each episode, we'll explore the real-world challenges and opportunities facing today's human performance professionals.
Our hands-on experience is transforming sports medicine and breaking barriers through innovation and teamwork.
Everybody, welcome to this week's Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast. This week we have Danny Hultson, former Major League Baseball player and pitcher, now front office for the Chicago Cubs. He's a good friend of Dr. Roth.
Very special episode today. I'm joined today by my close friend, Danny Hultson. Some of you may already know who he is. He's former number two overall pick in the Major League Baseball and one of the most talented left-handed pitchers of his generation. But honestly, his story is not just about baseball. It's about his resilience and battling through complex injuries and rehab and actually making it to the peak of his sport with the Chicago Cubs. He's currently with the Cubs in a front office position, working with the major and minor league players. But most importantly, he's a close friend, a tremendous person, and he's going to offer us a lot of insight on what it's like in professional sports, rehab, mindset, and more. So Danny, thanks for joining us, buddy.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.
So Danny, after that little bio, do you mind giving us a background on your life and high school through college all the way to where you are now?
Sure. Yeah, of course. So yeah, baseball has always been a love of mine, a passion of mine. I started playing when I was 5 years old and my older brother, you know, was into baseball as well. So getting to play with him and go to his practices. And while he was practicing, my dad and I would be out in the other field or out in the outfield playing catch. And that's really when the passion started to grow. And yeah, I remember those days fondly with just playing catch with my dad and my brother out in the outfield. Those are good days. And it kind of progressed after that. Certainly, I started playing more travel baseball and more like highly competitive baseball growing up. There's some awesome opportunities where I grew up in Maryland, and I just started playing more and I loved it and slowly got better at it. Kind of progressing into high school, I was a late bloomer. I was about 5'8" as a freshman. So I had the skills, but not the size. So that was for a kid that wanted to be a professional baseball player, that being the dream, there was a little bit of hesitancy, just not having the body. But luckily I grew a lot. My junior and senior year, I started throwing harder. I started getting some attention from professional scouts. And I really wanted to go to college. Going to the University of Virginia was another dream of mine. And I always kind of pictured myself going to college and then hopefully pitching in the major leagues after that. So, you know, despite some attention from professional scouts, I decided to go to University of Virginia, which was the best decision of my life. And that was a tremendous opportunity and a tremendous experience on many, many levels. I grew up as a person. I grew up as a baseball player. And as my time at UVA continued, the attention from professional scouts grew and grew. And I was selected in the first round of the draft, which was an amazing, amazing thing to happen. I didn't in a million years think that I was going to go that high. But after my junior year, I went into professional baseball. And unfortunately, that's pretty much when my shoulder injury started happening. I had aches and pains here and there as a growing up and playing travel ball and that kind of stuff. Nothing too serious. And unfortunately, as my professional career just starting to get going, so were my injuries. So I had to have surgery basically right in my second year of professional baseball. And it was a pretty extensive surgery. I had torn my rotator cuff, my capsule, and my labrum all in various different ways. And it was a pretty heavy hit when I heard that. The doctors told me that there was a very good chance that I would never throw a ball again or certainly not play professional baseball again, but I still wanted to give it every opportunity I could. So rehabbed that and got to a point where I felt like I was back in 2015, 2016. But unfortunately, that did not last very long. I had these spurts where I was feeling like I was back to my former self, but then that quickly dissipated and my shoulder felt like crap again. So I needed another surgery. And that was basically the same thing all over again. I had retorn my rotator cuff capsule and labrum in just in different ways. So I had to get a brand new shoulder all over again. And after that, I actually went back to UVA to finish my degree. And that was looking back on it, that was an awesome, awesome thing to reset, just kind of get away from the game for a little bit, go back to school, just kind of have a little restart. And our athletic trainer there, I owe him my career. He, out of the willingness of his own goodwill, he rehabbed me. We did all the exercises. We did all the stuff. Our pitching coach at UVA got me through the throwing programs and I thank them for so much. They've been incredible to me, and I certainly would not have gotten to where I did without them. So when I was fully ready to go and fully healthy again, I got to sign with the Chicago Cubs, which is another tremendous opportunity, and took a year or so of kind of rehabbing and slowly moving back into things. But I got an opportunity to pitch in the major leagues, which was a dream come true in 2019. So it was certainly a long, long road, but I'm very proud of being able to get up to the major leagues and got to pitch a little bit, got to pitch in Wrigley Field, which was an amazing experience. And then after that 2019 season, unfortunately, shoulder injuries came back again, and I got to the point where I had two surgeries. I was looking at a third one, and I just kind of had this feeling in my stomach that it was the end of my playing career, which was unfortunate, but there's a lot of positives that came out of it. So I still have a passion for baseball. I still love baseball. And even though I can't play anymore, I have this awesome opportunity to work in the front office. So I get to live out my love for baseball just in a different way now. So that's what I've been doing recently, is working up in the front office as the manager of pitching. So I get to do a lot of everything involved in pitching within the Cubs organization, player development, acquisition, a bunch of different things. So I get to see baseball in a whole different light now. And that's kind of that was a little bit long-winded, but that's kind of my story with baseball, and here we are now.
It's amazing. I remember that week in 2019 when you got called up, and we were all there, and you flew in all your buddies from DC and around the country, and I was living in Chicago at the time, and you're watching you there at Wrigley pitching, and we all went out on the field with you, and like seeing you at the culmination of your career, especially after 7-8 years of just working as hard as you possibly can. It was an incredible, incredible moment to see.
I remember that day. That's still top days of my life.
What was your experience with the rehab? You mentioned a little bit about your athletic trainer at UVA. How did that differ from professional level, athletic trainers, physical therapists, if there's any sports scientists involved at that time? Did you notice a big difference from that, from when you first came out until 2019? Was there a big difference, or were you kind of working on the same type of protocols and, I guess, schedules as you would have as when you were back at UVA?
Yeah. So I had, I got very lucky to be able to work with a lot of very, very smart, hardworking people that knew exactly what, knew their stuff, knew the programs, were very, very supportive in everything that I did. I think the difference comes in just their resources, honestly, with professional baseball and, high school and collegiate sports. But the programs were generally the same. I think just the access to just these different modalities and different types of resources that you have at the professional level, whether it's the different types of stim machines or different whatever, fancy thing is boosting recovery these days. The pro sports are going to have that, where collegiate sports may not have access to that. But as far as like the rehab process, it was pretty much the same. I think that generally gets a little bit of a difference between pro and college is just like the timing and the process is very, very similar. I think, that everyone has a little bit their own different look on how to rehab, on how to go about strengthening certain muscles, or the best way to do this, or the best way to gain mobility. But everybody has those little different things. But the goal is the same, obviously. It's just get back healthy on the field. I think one of the good things about going back to school was I had an unbelievable great relationship with our athletic trainer there, Brian McGuire. We call him BMAC. He knew exactly how I moved. He knew exactly what it took to get back to being that version of myself that, got me drafted where I did. And the big thing with him, I think, was just learning how to be patient. That was one thing that I took from him, was that I think at times in my professional rehab career, I felt a lot of pressure to get back to who I was really fast as I possibly could. You know, have these Adrian Peterson rehab stories where you tear everything in your body, but you come back even stronger. And I think, you know, talking with him and having long conversations with him about how these things take time and you can't rush them and you have to listen to your body and you need to get out of your own head. Those were the most valuable things that I took away from that, the rehabbing again in college.
Yeah, I'd have to say, I always preface that with athletes is how well we know the athlete, and then to be able to understand the total athlete, not just the body part we're working with, but also the mental component. And it sounds like you had a great relationship where that stood true with your athletic trainer at UVA, is that he knew exactly how you performed and what you needed and maybe the buttons to push to get you where you needed to be. So that was the one thing that I noticed in my level of athletics. It's, we see someone for 4 years, and college, you might have that person for 4 years unless they leave. But you're dealing with multiple sports where pros are dealing with one sport, right? So that can be also challenging to be able to, you might get a little spread a little thin, but I think it's definitely the mental component is huge. And it sounds like you guys did a great job of kind of honing that in.
Yeah, that's one of the big things that I learned through the whole experience, was to look at things in the long term versus just the short term. You know, it's really easy to put pressure on yourself to get healthy immediately and be even better than you were before and do more and do get as mobile as you can or get as strong as you possibly can. And, you know, you'll if you're not, you know, twice as strong as you were before, then you're failing at. You're a failure, honestly. Like, you know, it feels like that sometimes in the rehab process, but being able to manage those expectations and being able to look at things months and year or two from now, as opposed to everything that has to happen today type of mentality, that was a huge thing that I learned. And it kind of spreads out even outside of sports, just, you know, things in general, that you just kind of have a longer term view of things.
Where do you think a lot of that pressure was coming from? Do you think it was coming from internal, from yourself, or did you feel it from other players or any of the teams or your family, or what do you think?
That's a great question. I think, you know, having a lot of time to think about this and that whole experience, that 99% of it came from me, and it was all made up in my own head. You know, I had these lofty expectations of myself, which are, you know, I think is healthy as an athlete. You want to be the best you possibly can be. You want to get to the highest level. I started to conflate that with making other people happy. Right. So, you know, I got drafted very high, higher than I ever thought I would. You know, along with that came some, you know, assurances that I was good. But there was also a lot of insecurities that I needed to prove myself. I needed to prove that I was worth, you know, getting picked that high. I was better. I was as good as all the other high draft round picks. And I put these huge, huge expectations on myself. So, you know, when those weren't met, I did more. I threw hard. I worked harder. I did more in the gym. I did more in the training room. It was all out of fear of like not living up to these expectations. And I think that's honestly what kept me hurt, was, you know, trying to live up to those expectations all the time. I think when, you know, pitched that first professional year and I walked a bunch of guys or gave up a bunch of runs, I felt like a failure, and I felt like I had to, you know, throw through the discomfort that I was feeling that first professional season. You know, my arm hurt. I was probably not healthy, but I didn't say anything because I didn't want to be a disappointment to anybody. And, you know, that goes back to the short term and long term type of thinking, where I'd have a bad outing and think that, you know, I was failing everybody and disappointing people. I'm all because I had one or two bad outings, when in reality, that was all it was one or two bad outings. So that pressure that I think fed the insecurities and fed like all the stuff that I was doing to try to get healthy, all 99% of it came from me, which is, you know, something I've grown away from and learned a lot from. But that certainly was, I think that was the reality of the situation, was that I just put these unhealthy expectations on myself.
Do you think, as a early 20-year-old, fresh out of having an incredible college career, drafted very high, going to dinner with Felix Hernandez, they give you some decent amount of money, do you think it's possible to have that kind of perspective in that position as a early 20-year-old rising pitcher? Or obviously, we're looking back now and we can say, oh, we're very mature and we know what we should have done. But at that time, when you've been drafted and the whole world is your oyster and you just want to grind and be the best pitcher possible, do you even think it's possible? I mean, you look at all these young guys, Dansby Swanson, Vanderbilt, Paul Skeens, et cetera. Like, do they have or have they been taught this mindset that you're talking about? Or are they still struggling with the things that you struggled with when you were drafted?
That's a good question. I think it's certainly possible. I think, you know, everything's on a spectrum, right? Like, you can be the most confident, irrationally confident type of dude where you get drafted that high and it's, you know, it's obviously they would take me that high. I'm that good. I'm going to be this all-star. I'm going to be this superstar player versus the super insecure guy where, you know, oh my gosh, like I'm not good enough to even pitch at all. Like, I can't even function. I got to do that. It's certainly a spectrum. I think where, you know, I fell more on that insecure side where just naturally kind of a people pleaser, just trying to make people happy and living for that type of thing at that age versus someone that's more naturally inclined to be a little bit more self-assured and just a little bit more confident with who they are. And, you know, it's, to your point, I think that's a difficult thing for a young person to have, but, you know, I think the difficulty that I had was just realizing that and talking about it. You know, I think that was one of the, you know, several mistakes that I made in that age, you know, whether it's maturity levels or not, or even expected out of a young 20s guy to be able to recognize that. But I just didn't talk about it with anyone. I didn't, you know, wasn't open with how I was feeling, or I think that because, you know, that made me feel weak and that made me feel exposed and that made me feel like I was letting people down if I even admitted that I was going through that. So I think there's certainly some natural tendencies that are that way with young athletes. But, you know, I think everybody take the action of just admitting about where they're at.
So knowing what you know now, what you've been through as a young 20 something to now in a front office position, working with minor league and prospective or prospect players, what's your message to them on the mental and physical component? Like what you went through, how to manage it, how to mentally grasp it so they can be the best they can be and maybe have a better experience and not feel like, you know, the world's on their shoulders. Are they going to let people down to be able to perform the best that they can? And then to be able to go to the right or get the right resources to make sure that they are healthy mentally and physically. What's that message from you as a front office person now?
Yeah, it certainly depends on the situation. I think the conversations that I've had with players about this kind of stuff is all dependent on their own circumstances and their own situations. But, you know, a lot of it is building confidence and building self-assurance and how valuable that is. And honestly, just giving the middle finger to anybody else that is outside the picture. I think that I think that there are some components of trying to live up to expectations and living up to prospect ranking lists and that type of thing. And it's something that I don't know if anybody admits, but I think internally, if everyone looked deep down, it does have an impact on them, good way or bad way. Like if there's a guy that is a top prospect and he doesn't feel like he's that good, or the guy that is the top prospect and isn't as good as other people thinks he is, but, you know, it certainly depends on the situation. I think the big thing is that long-term perspective that I talked about. I think talking with guys, if they have a bad outing or a bad bullpen, and, you know, they're so competitive and they're so hard on themselves that you can see like a, you know, eruption, like an internal eruption of emotion after they, you know, throw a bad live BP or have a bad game. But I think that looking at things like everything is just so long-term in professional baseball, having that perspective at that age, I think is so valuable because it just feels like everything matters and everything has an impact on your future when it probably doesn't. Like nothing in the micro affects the macro that much. If things become patterns and, you know, consistent, then that's one thing. But just having this almost caring less, I think, is a valuable message to a lot of these guys. They're just so intent on achieving their goals, which is absolutely valuable. And like, we want that mentality, but they're going to play so much baseball. They're going to throw so many pitches that it just doesn't make sense to get down on one or two bad outings. And I think that goes a long way of having that kind of perspective.
Do you think the external pressure is actually more now for a high draft pick or someone who has high expectations coming out than it was for you? I mean, we're more connected than ever. Everyone always talks about social media. Do you think, or was it just different? Was the pressure just different when you were coming up?
I think the pressure is probably the same. I think it's just more visible for these guys now, you know, with social media and being just out in the public eye more. I think that makes it a little bit more present in their own eyes. you know, versus when I was coming up, there was Twitter, there was Baseball America and all that good stuff, but it wasn't like instilled in our culture like it is now. So I think guys get a little bit more exposed to it now, which, you know, may or may not have, you know, probably has a bad impact, but some guys love it and some guys think that, you know, gain confidence from that type of thing. You know, at the end of the day, it's about being a productive Major League Baseball player. And if there's stuff on social media that gives you fuel and gives you confidence versus read all the bad shit that people talking crap about you, then, you know, that's one thing. It's another battle that these guys have to face that in my scenario, I didn't, even though I made up a lot of that in my own head.
I like how earlier you mentioned, well, about 5 minutes ago, about giving people the middle finger, because there's a couple of great questions here of like, how does the media really know what's going on? And also people out externally from the organization, because we know that in pro sports, everybody's a doctor, everybody's a rehab specialist. When you see that, as I said before we started recording, the Red Sox first baseman went down with a patella tendon injury last night. Like, everybody's a critic, everybody knows what's going on. How does that affect you as a player and the players that are in the organizations when it comes to external noise? And how does that really create, I guess more noise within the organization or with yourself? Do you guys know how to tune that out? Is that something that you have to work at as a young professional? Is that what you talk about with the players coming up, and how does that, you know, affect their process of development?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think like with the world of social media that we live in now, like developing the skill of blocking out the noise is essential. You know, I think it's a genuine skill that you have to develop when, you know, you talk about not caring as much. Like, that's part of it, is like you have to learn to not care what other people think and what other people are saying. Yeah, and that can be tough for some guys. I think if I were in that position at that age, it would have affected me, because, you know, you care about living up to expectations. But at the end of the day, it's about what you can do personally to achieve your goals and be a productive major leaguer and living your dream out, playing at Wrigley Field or playing at Fenway. It's like, what can you do? And just having this kind of, and that perspective and understanding that none of this other stuff helps. Like, it's probably not going to help you. It may, yeah, sure, like we were talking about, you know, it may give you confidence to see your name on a prospect list or something like that, or getting interviews, but blocking out the negativity and the noise and all the bullshit that comes along with that, I think that's a skill that, you know, more so now than ever, guys have to develop. And, you know, I think it goes back to confidence and self-assurance and understanding who you are and why you're playing. I think, you know, identifying that why is super important. If you asked me at age 20 if why I was playing, it was because I loved it, enjoyed it, but also I wanted to, you know, live up to these expectations and make people happy, and which is not something that anyone would encourage these days or ever, honestly. But, you know, you can, just talking with guys, you can get a little bit of a sense that that matters to them. So I think just talking with these guys about understanding their true motivations and their true understandings of themselves, I think goes a really long way.
Yeah, you know, we talk quite often with young athletes, you know, high school athletes. I've been in collegiate and high school athletics most of my career. I did a little professional sports. But the high school kids, when they have an injury, they feel like they're letting their whole team down, their coaches down. And we have to have the conversation all the time about, you know, it's about you. It's not about anybody else. You know, one, how do you feel? How do you think you can perform? What's the positives and the negatives to you returning early or not returning at all? What does this do for you for the next season? So there's a lot of conversations that goes into it, that goes into the process of rehabilitation or performance. So I think having that at younger ages is important, it's paramount. And I think it's a key indicator for us to be able to set somebody up for success later in life. And it sounds like that's something that you would have great influence with your players that you're working and developing with now. So that's great.
Yeah, I think to that point, I think a difference in professional baseball, certainly at the minor league level, is, you know, it sounds bad, but it's inherently a selfish game, because nobody in minor league baseball wants to be where they're at right now, right? They want to be up. They want to progress. It's not really about winning the Pacific Coast League anymore. It's not about winning the Southern League. It's not about winning the Midwest League. It's about producing major league baseball players. So that challenge of letting your teammates down is certainly real. I do think it's a little bit different in professional baseball. It's certainly the minor league level. Those conversations are very real at the major league level. You hear stories of guys playing through injuries during a playoff race. I remember in my limited time of playing in the majors, Anthony Rizzo had twisted his ankle, and it was legitimately the size of softball. It was a small basketball. It was huge. And he was out there grinding because we were in a playoff race. And utmost respect to that guy to play through that, because we needed him. He was an integral part of our team. And if it were any other situation, go sit on the couch, go ice and elevate. Dude, you're fine. Like, we're going to be all right. But that dude grinded it out. And you could see it. You know, I don't know if there's any videos of it. But, you know, I remember him hitting a ball off the wall and just hobbling the second. And it was a huge message to our guys about, like, this is something bigger than me. You know, that's certainly a rare situation. But that is a difference in especially minor league baseball, where it's like we're in the playoff hunt for whatever league that we're in. But, you know, you could be a major leaguer and we're going to pump the brakes on you, buddy.
We've talked before about the dynamic in a professional locker room and that how it's filled with multimillionaire superstars and then minor league grinders and everyone in between. And that I think everyone's working towards the same goal, but not everyone necessarily is friends. And that, you know, if you retire or move to another team, you don't really keep in contact with these people. What is that dynamic like for anyone who's never been in a professional locker room?
So it's like being a good teammate is obviously vital for team success. I think if guys are not going towards the same goals and not supporting each other, you know, that's going to lead to more losses in the long run. Absolutely. You know, then it's like trying to relate it to, I guess, non-sports, it's similar to, I guess, coworkers, where you have good relationships, you have professional relationships, but it's a little bit more than that, right? Like, it's, you know, you grind stupid conversations with these guys, you go through a ton of adversity, you go through a ton of success with these guys, but there is like a little bit more of a professional element than it is with like maybe your college or high school teammates, where maybe you're at a more impressionable age and, you know, you bond with these people a little bit differently. So yeah, that it is a strange relationship where when you're in the moment, when you're in that locker room, you are, you know, trying to be the best teammate you possibly can be, supporting each other, whether it's just a simple conversation or just hanging out with the guys. But it is a little bit strange that when it's over, that is kind of over. You always have a relationship with these people, but it's not like you're best friends with them. It's a little bit of a, I've been, you know, lucky enough that I've only had a real job for a couple of years. I got to play sports for most of my life, but I do see a little bit of that, a parallel with coworkers. It's that, you know, these people are fantastic. You're fun to work with. You guys do great things together and help people get better. But at the end of the day, you got other stuff going on. You might have a family, you might have kids, you might have other stuff going on, where, you know, going out and getting a beer or doing some dumb stuff like you did in college, like that ain't happening.
Is there anyone in the locker rooms that you looked up to as a mentor, whether their work ethic or they had a similar story to you or how to act as a professional? I know you've kept a couple friends from your major league days, some are maybe from college and then some are from guys you've met along the way, but it's probably few and far between. Is there anyone you looked up to, and you don't even have to have a longstanding relationship with them, but is there someone that has been served as a mentor for you?
Yeah, I think I didn't talk to him very much, but you guys will know this guy. John Lester was a guy that I looked up to growing up, you know, left-handed pitcher, just hyper competitive guy. Getting to be around him had a big impact on how I looked at baseball, honestly. It was a really funny distinction. Certainly, he worked his ass off, did all the right things. He was a vocal leader and led by example, all those fantastic things. One really interesting thing that I noticed about him, he had this ability to remove himself from his pitching. And what I mean by that is, you know, all the things that we talk about where, you know, you think everything's the end of the world, you think you suck if you pitch badly, you think you're a terrible person, you think that you're a failure. The thing that he did that I noticed, and I don't know if this was conscious or not, or just kind of his natural personality, but the way he talked about pitching, he took himself out of it in a way that was like, yeah, the fastball wasn't very good today. I didn't locate the fastball very well. The cutter wasn't where it usually is. And that small distinction of the versus my is like a, I think, a really powerful thing, because if you think my fastball wasn't very good, that turns into I wasn't very good and I suck. But it was a really small distinction that I thought was so powerful, that he just could take himself out of his identity as a player and from on and off the field just by that little like cueing of calling his pitches that way. I thought that was really, really powerful. I never talked to him about it, but those little things like that, and I think had a big impact, you know, why he was so successful in his career. And I have no idea if that was like a conscious or a real thing, but I just thought that was so interesting, because when you hear guys talk about their outings, it was, I did this, we did that, I did this, I executed this pitch, my pitch very well, my curveball was nasty, my, all that. You know, and that works for some guys, but just that small distinction of saying the was just, there's John Lester and then there's John Lester, the player on the mound. And separating the two is often a huge challenge, kind of connected to what we were talking about earlier about taking such an identity as a baseball player and everything revolves around your success on the mound and on the field. That is so valuable to be able to separate the two.
He was a beast in New England. You know, being a lifelong Red Sox fan, that was probably one of the biggest misses on our part to keep him here. I was like, if I could have gone down to Fenway, and I don't want to say burn down Fenway, but I think a lot of people were upset about that trade, or, you know, not signing him, because he was amazing as far as, you know, his work ethic, what we saw. A good friend of mine was the head of their physical therapy for the Red Sox, and he said he was a grinder, and that's the best thing about him. And he taught a lot of the young players. You know, he came up as a young player and he was a veteran by the time he left, and the World Series championships. And it's tough to get that now, especially with pitchers, right? But to have that relationship, it sounds like it was a good one for you to be able to get that type of inside his head, I would say, and get to see what he actually was thinking and how he was developing as a player.
Yeah, he probably doesn't remember my name or anything like that, but just those... even though we didn't have like a tight relationship or any sort of real relationship at all, it was just being around him that had that impact on me. And I'm sure it had impact on countless other players, that, you know, things you're talking about, work ethic and grinding through things, that goes a really long way, you know, over the course of a long season, as, you know, how you go about your business. And a guy like that, just that was so diligent and so prepared and did it, had a routine that he stuck to so consistently, was that has an impact, you know, not only for himself, but just other people watching it. And I think, you know, I was certainly that guy that was watching that type of thing. And that's the type of impact that you want out of that type of guy. He makes people better. He makes the players around him better, not even super intentionally, not saying, hey, throw your curveball like this, do that. He's certainly open to all of that. But just the way that these guys go about their business is super powerful.
Do you know what he's doing now? Is he still, I mean, he's out of the league, but is he working in some professional capacity?
Not that I know of, no. You know, he might be hunting and fishing and playing golf, living the World Series, you know, potential Cy, or perennial Cy Young winner lifestyle, that type of thing. I have no idea what he's doing.
As far as recovering from injury as a professional athlete, and you can dance around this however you like, but being in the front office now, I think there's one of the things that we hear about injury, but we don't know how much that we hear is truth versus what you can release as a professional organization, given healthcare privacy acts and things of that nature. How much does the general public typically know about injury and recovery for athletes, and what are the organizations allowed to release at that capacity?
That's a good question. I'm not violating HIPAA or anything like that, but probably like the extent of injuries is probably not all that public. You know, at least you hear, you know, you look on the bottom line and it says like, you know, this guy's out with Tommy John surgery, or this guy's out with hip surgery. But to the extent and the details of that are probably, you know, those are kept a little bit more private for whatever reason. I think, you know, whether it's a patient doctor confidentiality type thing, or, you know, there's no reason to say how extensive a surgery was or how, you know, damaging an injury is. But that's probably something that a lot of the time these injuries are like way more serious than you think.
Than they're letting on to be. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Guys are, at least in baseball, like, I don't know if anyone's ever playing at 100%. I don't know if anyone's ever playing at 90%. Like, that's a part of the grind of professional baseball, is that like you're never fully healthy. There may be a day or two where you feel amazing, but oh my gosh, it is a grind. It does not stop. You are expected to perform at a high, high level every time you're out there, but you are not feeling good most of the time. I think, you know, a lot of guys would, you know, resonate with that or, you know, agree with that. It's just like the days of being able to pick up a ball and play catch and be ready to go, like, hell no, those days are long gone. So managing how you're feeling and being able to perform when you're not 100% is another thing that you have to learn how to deal with and learn how to do as you progress through the minors and, you know, progress through the majors. I think that's one thing that the media maybe not has a total grasp of is like even the guys on the field, there's a good chance that there's something going on. You know, the details and the extents of that differ in every situation, but guys are dealing with shit and they're dealing with shit all of the time.
Yeah, when our players get hurt in spring training, have a hand fracture or something, and we'll give them a basic timeline, and then you'll see the media post, you know, this player is out with a broken hand and he's going to be out for 4 to 6 weeks. So yeah, all of that is true, but obviously the mechanism and what type of injury in specific is left out, and that's probably for the better. You talk about feeling poorly a lot of the time, and we've talked about this personally, but how much does the nutrition or supplementation that the team, how much does that affect individual performance, team performance, and how much of that does the team and organization control for you guys?
That's a good question. I think they control as much as they can. I think, you know, at the end of the day, you're dealing with adults that are making their own choices. The only thing you can do is provide them with the information and provide them with the resources that help them achieve their goals. It's still up to the player to, you know, eat healthy, get enough sleep, drink enough water, take the right supplements. All of those resources are totally, you know, most of the time, very available to you. It's still up to the player to act on it and be consistent with it, which is, you know, can be a huge challenge. You know, it can be a challenge for these guys in the minor leagues on the road when, you know, there's not a ton of great quality options wherever they're at. The organizations do everything they can to get, at least the Cubs do. I can't speak for other organizations, but I would expect that they do everything they possibly can to put these guys in a position to succeed with nutrition and supplements and all that stuff. It can be difficult for players to be consistent with it. And because at the end of the day, you're dealing with adults sometimes you're dealing with kids. Like you're dealing with 17 or 18 year old kids that, you know, don't really realize the impact of eating a Big Mac at midnight or eating 3 Chick-fil-A sandwiches before they go to bed. Like guys just don't care. Like they don't realize, or maybe not they don't care, but they don't realize the impact that that's having. And, you know, that's another thing that you notice just watching guys that have had success and have had longevity in the game is like they care about that stuff and they're very consistent with it. Back to John Lester, he had a case of water that was in front of his locker the day before a start, every start, and there was, you know, 12 or 14 or whatever bottles in there, and every single one of them was drank by the end of the day. And that was just another one of those little things that guys notice and things that have an impact and how important it is. But drinking water like that consistently is fucking hard. And it's easy to say, like from an outsider's perspective, like, oh yeah, you just eat healthy. You drink all the water. You drink nothing but, or you'd eat nothing but the healthiest organic foods all of the time. Like you're a professional athlete and you're getting paid millions of dollars. And that's absolutely true. In reality, that being consistent with that stuff is very, very hard because people are human beings at the end of the day and they want a cheeseburger every once in a while. And they don't, you know, they may go out and have a beer with their friends. Like that stuff happens too. That guys deal with that all of the time. But it's so important to be able to be consistent with that stuff. And, you know, you're just putting yourself at a disadvantage if you're not being very diligent with that type of stuff.
That was Cam's downfall to becoming the next Tom Brady, as he was hitting up Wendy's and McDonald's pregame.
not pregame. I'm also missing about 6-7 inches in height, maybe about.
I kept telling him he's gonna be a late bloomer and he was the next Brady, but he's gone on to bigger and better things, yeah, than being one of the top surgeons in upper extremity surgery.
Thanks, Riz. That's very kind. I will tell you, for all our Chicago listeners, the Chicago White Sox also have a top-notch training and supplementation program. So both teams are represented equally and working towards the same goal of winning the World Series.
I was going to say the other Chicago team, but
no, we have a name.
Yeah. Danny, on the side of, you know, performance aids, or what about sleep aids? Is there anything that, like, talk around the organization about there's a lot of people that like to use sleep aids, meaning like Oura Rings or Whoops or devices to help them with their sleep patterns. I know I talked to a colleague of mine that's one of the athletic trainers for the Red Sox, and he had mentioned there's some guys that do use them, coaching staff uses them, but some of the players don't like to have them on after, you know, when they're out traveling, because they don't want the staff to look at the metrics and see really what's going on, like if they're out late or whatnot. So is there any conversation on how to improve that if athletes are suffering from recovery? Just want a little insight on what you guys might be doing or what you maybe are discussing for future performance enhancement.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, you know, kind of similar to what we're talking about, I think from the organization's standpoint, like your job is to put the player in a position to succeed, do everything you possibly can, right? Like there's battles that come with that, you know, financially, one of them. Like, I don't know if any, even the richest organizations are going to give every single person an Oura ring or, and then combine that with getting people to wear them, right? Like you can't, that's just one, you're not going to be able to force people to do that. But that, I think you bring up a good point about, there's this weird battle between players and front office sometimes where there's this viewpoint where from a player's perspective, things that could be are recommended from the org, whether it be, hey, like wear this ring to track your sleep or do this or do that. It's a weird thing, but players very often see that as a way to be used against them. So if we gave this every player an Oura ring or a Whoop band and said, hey, we're going to track, like, we want to track your sleep, we want to track your recovery, this is all in an effort to make you prepared as best as you possibly can, this is all in an effort to help you, to put you in a position to succeed. In theory, that makes sense, right? There's probably irrational fear that if there's a metric on a Whoop band that says this guy's not sleeping, then that's going to be used against them somehow, or they're not hitting their goals of calorie, whatever the thing is being tracked. There's just this expectation or this perspective that somehow this will be used against me. You know, something that we battle all the time with, you know, some of our throwing programs and some of our, you know, initiatives that we try to get these guys to do, all in an effort because we want them to succeed. But there is something about, you know, the front office player tension that brings that out where, I've been fine. I've been recovering well. I've been throwing 95. I've been, you know, I ain't giving up runs. I'm striking guys out. Like, I don't need that. Like, you're only going to use it against me. That happens. You know, again, we're dealing with humans that have, you know, maybe sometimes irrational expectations or irrational perspectives. But to your question about those aids and those, you know, things that we try to provide our players, we do everything we can, right? Like those, I think we have some guys wearing Whoop bands, we have some guys wearing Oura rings, but that's a decision that they make on themselves, for themselves. Not, we can't say you have to do this or else, because then again, like that tension builds and, you know, that's not healthy for anybody. So if guys are curious about that type of stuff, then we do what we can to support them. But yeah, again, you can't force them to do anything, but if there's something that can help a guy, we're going to do it for sure.
Yeah, I think the main thing that we try to, you know, discuss with young athletes is we're trying to provide a better environment for you to heal and recover so you can stay active and healthy. And our job is prevention mainly, right? We're there for trauma and evaluation and treatment once it happens. But how do we avoid it at all costs? And the younger kids we're seeing, for instance, it's they get up early, they go to school, they're at school all day, they get out of school, they go to practice, they don't eat properly because breaks of lunch or snack time or whatever they have is broken up. Then they're burning the candle at both ends because they have, you know, practice, games, get home late, homework, go to bed late, get up early. Like there's that whole cyclical process where they're not recovering. So if we give them a data point or give them a visualization chart, they can see that and they see improvement. It's like for them, it's a light bulb goes off. Now you're dealing with collegiate professional athletes. What are they doing? They're just playing the sport all the time. So for them, I can see that point as being, well, I'm doing fine. I'm not injured. My performance is where it needs to be. My metrics are where they need to be. Why do I need to wear this? So I think going into it in a mindset of, hey, if I can reduce the chance of me being injured and off the field, might be a better conversation. But I guess that's, you know, again, player to player, organization to organization. But I think one of the questions that we had, Cam and I were talking about is, you know, how does performance-based data analytics work within the organization or other organizations? Outside of the sleep performance, how does 3D motion capture, force play technology, biomechanical and kinematic evaluations and visualization, how has that changed since you started as a young professional to now? And how is that helping to improve athlete performance? And we can get into, I think, some of the other the groups that are out there or companies that are out there. But some of the stuff that I've seen over the past several years, I went and back and got my another master's in applied sports science analytics. And where 3D motion capture was when I started to now is completely different. Now it's markerless. You can do machine learning, which is amazing. And I guess it's just what you have available. So can you speak a little bit to maybe what you might have been exposed to as a young collegiate and professional athlete and maybe what you see now in within your organization, or maybe speak to other people that you know in other organizations and what they might be using?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the resources and the data is light years ahead of where I was. You know, I think we had radar guns, certainly we had, but that was about it. So now we have motion capture systems. We have TrackMan that measures the movement of your pitches. We have almost anything that can be measured. We are measuring and we're constantly doing it. Every, you know, affiliate has, and every stadium in professional baseball, and even now collegiate stadiums have some sort of motion capture system and some sort of pitch tracking system and some sort of batted ball tracking system. So the impact that that's having is tremendous, and it's vastly different than when I was playing. You know, just speaking my own experience, you know, the motion capture stuff would have been, I think, a total game changer for me. I think that at that time we relied on video and kind of these subjective lenses, which is super, you know, can be super valuable because there are things the data does not capture, but the access to this stuff is just so, so prevalent that, you know, when I was pitching, looking back, I threw totally different in college than I did in pro ball. And like that, if I were playing right now, that would have been flagged yesterday. That would have been flagged immediately, you know, that my mechanics had changed, and that would have, you know, potentially changed the course of someone's career. And looking at my career, like I, you know, stepped super far across my body because it felt better for my arm to throw that way when I was hurting. And then, yeah, people would say, yeah, you're stepping a little bit across your body. And, you know, there'd be a way to your point earlier about a data point. It's like you are stepping 18 inches further across your body than you used to. And like that, even that little, you know, light bulb moment would be like, oh my gosh, that's so much worse than I thought it was. I got to change that now. And that, you know, just wasn't available. And that, you know, certainly not an excuse for anything. I'm just saying it certainly changes how you go about things and how quickly you can react to some things. And that's, you know, a big part of my job now is just on the lookout for those types of changes and on the lookout for any sort of progressions in biomechanics or pitch movement and figuring out why they're happening and figuring out what to do about it. You know, that's kind of what it comes down to. So that stuff is present in every single organization. It's just so, so valuable to quantify what's going on, and then the gap in what those things are measuring and what to do about it and what really matters. So those things are constantly changing, right? They're constantly evolving, of being able to analyze a guy's delivery and say, this guy, if we change this one thing, he'll throw this much harder. Or if we change this pitch by this much, it'll perform this much better. Those types of things are constantly being worked on. But at least for the tracking stuff that we're able to quantify, that is every day in a front office for sure.
How much strength and conditioning of the lower body was focused on as a pitcher? Because we talk about this with young kids, like they're throwing, but they don't understand that your lower body is the most pivotal piece or foundational piece for a pitcher to develop and core stability because of the repetition and the duration and the endurance that you need as a thrower. How much of that did you see change from high school to college to professional level?
I think the biggest difference is like the proof about why it matters. I think that kind of anecdotally speaking, you saw guys like John Lester, and you saw guys with like Nolan Ryan that just had tree trunks for legs, and you know, Ken Griffey Jr. with his big butt just like sticking out of his uniform, and like you just kind of realize like maybe there's absolutely something to this, that, you know, lower body power and lower body explosiveness and mobility, that stuff matters. And we've, you know, over the years we've just gained a better understanding about how and why that matters. And I think it's something that guys are very conscious of and very aware that how important having a strong lower half is, and having a mobile lower half. And you see guys doing it all the time in the weight room, is focusing on their lower body strength, their lower body explosiveness, and their core stability. Like you mentioned, all of those things matter. And I think we did that stuff in high school and college, was, you know, try to squat and try to as big as legs and as powerful legs as you possibly can. I think the proof is stronger now. And then there's also some points where it's like, dude, you're strong enough. Like, you fly off the charts with all of these metrics. Like, we don't need to kill ourselves in the weight room. Yeah, we absolutely want to maintain your strength. But like, this isn't a focus for you as much as it is for this other guy that, you know, maybe younger, maybe lacking in some sort of metric. So I think just the presence of it is the same, but the understanding of it is much more clear now. And there's still things to work on. There's still things that we don't understand, but the access to data and you know, all the super smart people running the models that, you know, spit this information out, like, those are constantly being evolved and they're constantly improving. And there's just trying to gain a better understanding about how the lower body influences velocity or how it influences exit velocity. Those things are constantly evolving.
One follow-up, and I'll let Cam jump in here. I see the wheel spinning in his brain. As far as measuring that lower body strength, are you guys using force play technology like preseason, you know, spring training, in season, postseason? Is that how you're measuring those KPIs for the athlete?
All the time. Yeah, that's a constant thing and it tracks back to our, you know, what we were talking about earlier was recovery too. Is like, you're, you know, we're seeing you on these force plates that decline in your overall power, whatever it may be, like something going on. It's like, oh yeah, I didn't sleep great. I mean, something's been barking. I just haven't been able to do this or that for whatever reason. And like, that's another data point that says maybe we need to take a step back from weightlifting, let you recover a little bit more, and maybe take a day off from throwing. All of those things work hand in hand. And those force plates are a tremendous data point to point to. And, you know, I'm sure other organizations do it too. But another thing is just putting force plates on mounds and seeing how your lead leg is working, how you're blocking, how you're transferring energy up the chain, how you're generating force at the beginning of the delivery, how all that works. Those force plates, which didn't exist until maybe they existed, but they weren't a part of the game as they are now, you know, even 3 or 4 years ago, those things are pretty eye-opening and like influential in how we go about developing players.
How much does this sports science really translate into wins? Is it really all about the 18-inch change for the pitcher, or is it about signing Ohtani or Soto to $750 million over 15 years, right? Or is it a combination? Is it 50-50? Is it 75-25?
I don't know if I could put a number on it, honestly, but I can certainly speak to like what we're trying to achieve, right? Like, number one goal, win major league games. That is absolutely every single team's goal. We are trying to produce major league players that win major league baseball games. How you do that? You, on the pitching side, you prevent runs. You prevent runs by, you know, throwing strikes and having good pitches and locating them well and sequencing them well. You know, step below that is, how do you achieve those things? How do you throw hard? You have efficient mechanics. You are strong. You are this, you are that. So the sports science probably influences itself mostly on that bottom, you know, part of it, you know, a tree or whatever you want to call it. But it's just, when we are trying to produce major league players, we are also trying to maximize a guy's performance and give him every opportunity to succeed. And that's probably where sports science has its biggest influence, is that it maximizes these guys' talent as much as we possibly can. Not everybody's going to be a major league baseball player. Not everybody's going to be an all-star. Not everybody's going to play in double-A. But we're using this as an opportunity to put these guys in the best position they possibly can be. And that's certainly where sports science fits in the most. But at the end of the day, yeah, signing Ohtani probably is more important.
Yeah, he's a beast. So is Soto. But you guys on the Cubs have some rising stars like we talked about earlier. So I think there is absolutely a role for getting these really highly talented young players and then imbuing them with all the sports science possible to make them the best possible version of the player that they can become. And then it makes an enormous difference, and then they become a career all-star and become a dynasty player for your franchise.
That would be amazing. Yeah, that's the best case scenario. And then I think what happens more often is we just make these guys the best version of themselves, right? Like, that hope maybe is, you know, a generational type player. That may be an all-star. It may be a major leaguer. It may be a, you know, a major league regular. But it also might be a triple-A guy that fills in innings and like that is an organizational guy with that can cover innings. That's super. That type of thing is very important from an organization standpoint. So this foundational level of getting guys stronger and getting guys to move well and getting guys to recover, like, those are the core aspects of what puts them in a position to succeed. And, you know, that's where all this incredible information and modalities and different types of strategies come in. It's like that directly influences that, which then further downstream impacts your ability to win Major League Baseball games.
Completely switching gears, one final question. What's the best way to pass the time in the dugout or the bullpen when you're not pitching?
Eat hot dogs.
That's a great one. So I might be a little bit off my game now, but I think I knew every single riddle and every single outside the box word problem you could imagine. Those types of things can kill the time and kill innings where, you know, this guy's walking down the street with his dog and sees a red house and says, oh shit, like what's going on? And you can talk about that for 5 innings. Because guy, like you're just like, oh, maybe is he a fire? Like the red house, does that mean it's on fire? Is he a fireman? Is that his house? You go on, you talk about that for innings at a time. And then it comes out like he's playing Monopoly and he's the dog character and he landed on a hotel and he's lost all his money. Like that's stupid stuff like that. Stupid stuff like that goes so far in just killing time, one, and just building camaraderie and just like fucking around with the guys, like those types of riddles and whatever stupid games that you play. Those, honestly, those are like a lot of the things that I miss about playing is like, is that dumb shit that you go through with your teammates. And I think that's a great way. Hot dogs are not recommended, but we'll sub in maybe some sunflower seeds and gum.
There was a rumor that when Manny was playing, he would run in between innings and go to the bathroom and then he'd get pizza, eat pizza, and then come back out. And that's why his shirt was always untucked. And so he didn't get sauce on it, or it was like ridiculous.
Yeah, like it worked for him. One of the best right-handed hitters in the game's history. And like, you know, that's another thing that we battle all the time is like, if the goal is to be good at baseball, who cares how you get there? So obviously, everything we talked about, we think puts you in a position to get you there. But yeah, if you play video games until 2 a.m. or you eat pizza in between innings and you still ball out, like that's probably more valuable.
Yeah. No, what was it? My question to you is, what was the thing that was the most superstitious to you as a pitcher? Like what things would you do prior to a start or a workout? Like what was your thing if you had any?
Oh, I had a million. I had probably an unhealthy amount. You know, we can talk about why those things happened that, you know, kind of stems back to insecurity and, you know, thinking this matters because I'm not good enough. It's, you know, the fact that I ate spaghetti the night before was the reason I was good. So those superstitions, you know, they talk about the difference between superstition and routine, where you control your routine and your superstition controls you. I had a lot of things that controlled me with superstitions of what I ate or what, not stepping on the foul line or throwing off a certain mound or having a certain thought in my head or wearing the same shirt, wearing the same underwear, wearing the same sliders, wearing the same cleats. I had a million. For baseball players, I think are naturally pretty superstitious for whatever reason. But I was at a point where everything mattered and everything had an impact on the way I would pitch. And if it worked, I was sticking to it. If I ate just a banana before my start, no other food, that was it. Like I'm not, if it even has a little bit of peanut butter on it or whatever, or honey, whatever it is, like that was bad luck and I'm not going to do it. So I'm just going the regular banana.
So you weren't like Serrano from Major League with Jobu in your locker, like offering it gifts and...
I wasn't that far off, though. I was not that far off.
We actually, funny story, we have a surgeon here in Boston that played for Baylor, and he had a patient. They found out he played baseball. He's a second baseman, and they gave him a Jobu doll, and he has it in his room, in his office. And he said his biggest superstition now is when he signs off on a body part that he's operating on, he signs it with his initials and baseball number. That's his thing.
You get stuck into these things. Like it's a mental battle sometimes about like what really matters and what doesn't. Because you can convince yourself of anything, right? Like I ate the banana because it made me feel full and provided me with energy, but not too much energy where I felt slowed down, but enough where I could, you know, go throughout an outing and feel fueled. But like a banana or an apple and some peanut butter probably would have done the same shit. It just, there was something about the banana that had an impact bigger than its contents, right?
And then you have your Cubs fans at home watching you who are wearing their favorite Cubs shirt that they wear for every game, eating a banana because yesterday they ate a banana and you guys won. So them eating a banana makes you eat a banana, makes you pitch well, makes the Cubs win.
100%. I can guarantee that if you go to any major league sports stadium and walk around the stands, you will probably hear someone saying something about lucky seats or we gotta change up the juju. We gotta switch it up. That is everywhere. 100%. And that is the same thing with players too, is this is my seat. I don't sit anywhere else. Don't fuck with it. This cannot change because this has having an impact on the way I play. That's a real thing.
That was Cam every Friday night at Weston home basketball games.
You had your spot.
I was a big Weston high school basketball supporter.
Hell yeah.
He was super fan.
You sent me your report of your shoulder MRI arthrogram. I think it's from 2015 or 2016, and this may have been before your first surgery, if I'm not
I had my first surgery mistaken. In 2013.
Yeah, actually the date is cut off, so I'm not 100% sure, but on the report, there's no evidence of any anchors or hardware in there, so I'm not 100% sure. But the reason I'm talking about this is, if that's okay, I'd like to read a summary of your MRI arthrogram of your shoulder. And if there are any expert shoulder surgeons who end up listening to this, you can message me or Riz on LinkedIn or leave a comment on one of our social media or YouTube sites and just offer your expert opinion based on what I'm about to read. Now, I'm not 100% sure the surgery that Danny had. He's not 100% sure. He's never shared with me his operative report, so I can't make a comment on that. But I think reading it out loud, just the breakdown, I think would be very helpful for people. So this is an MRI arthrogram of his shoulder. He had a high-grade 80 to 90% partial thickness articular-sided tear of his supraspinatus. So it's a pasta, a lesion with about a third of the infraspinatus involved in some communication with the subdeltoid bursa. So really articular-sided and bursal-sided connecting tear. His biceps was actually intact. However, he did have a little bit of fraying at the superior labrum where it attaches at the 12 o'clock position on top of the glenoid. He did have some blunting and fraying in his posterior labrum, consistent more with a Bennett lesion or a posterior impingement. And then he had a 2 centimeter transverse and longitudinal tear in the lower half of his distal subscap tendon, and then some thinning and attenuation of the inferior glenohumeral ligament. Again, this is just the report, and I just summarized that report. But if anybody is out there, we interviewed Dr. J.P. Warner, very well-known shoulder surgeon from Mass General Hospital. We'll send this over to him and have him take a listen, but would be interested in anyone else's opinion.
That was a lot of big fancy words.
I know. They send us to school for a long time to say big fancy words. They're no riddle, you know, they're no bullpen riddles.
But. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but as you were reading that, I saw some head nods out of Andrew, and you were speaking to it like it was a second language, and I'm like, what?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because Cam and I chatted just briefly, like over text, because the advancements in shoulder surgery from when you had your initial injury to now have evolved. And there's different protocol and procedure now for certain injury. So I think one of the things we wanted to find out, like if this was today, like how would it maybe have been dealt with differently? And that's where I think it would be nice to see some insight from our colleagues and, you know, surgeons in the area. It'd be awesome.
Yeah, I have no idea the specifics of the surgery and stuff. Like Dr. Andrews did my surgeries and he was awesome. And he did a good job of dumbing it down and just being like, hey, we fixed you up. Like you were pretty messed up in there, but we'll get you all good. That was kind of the extent of it. That's all I needed to hear. But I'd be interested if like there was, you know, some new technique or some sort of procedure that would have changed. I don't know if it would have changed anything.
Well, Danny, you definitely got treated by the best in the business. There's no question about that. You received the gold standard of care. Would be interesting to look at your operative report. And I think this is a nice setting to educate us and to hear, to have involvement from other people around the country just to offer their comments. I think that'd be very helpful. I am not going to offer an operative opinion on Danny's MRI arthrogram read because I didn't examine him at the time. I wasn't able to look at the images. I have a general idea of what they probably did, but I'm not actually going to offer that. And they also say if you put 10 orthopedic surgeons in a room, you're going to get 10 different opinions.
That's a really interesting thing, actually. I talk about the, you know, some of the perspectives of what major leaguers or what baseball players go through, like from the perspective of players to doctors and surgeons. I honestly had I think at one point I had this kind of perspective that some surgeries were very simple, where you just put this here and you attach it there. And then there's other surgeries that require some sort of mastery and some sort of artistic nature of, you know, putting things together in the exact right way and making sure everything functions as it should and all of that. That's probably, or some surgeries have to be simpler than others, where others get more complex. And a lot of the time, it could be as easy as you could go see any doctor in the country and they'll fix you up just as well as anybody else. But there's probably some other surgeries and situations where, you know, someone's very expert, like experience and skills may be better for the individual.
Yeah, there's no question about that. There's more of your common boilerplate type injuries that the majority of orthopedic surgeons can take care of. But of course, as you know, in the major leagues, there's a small set of orthopedic surgeons that get all the pathology. So if you have an ulnar collateral ligament elbow injury, also known as a Tommy John injury, you're only seeing two or three orthopedic surgeons in the country. Even if your team doctor is a very skilled, technically skilled, very intelligent surgeon, you're going to go to Texas or you're going to go to LA to see these, or New York to see these well-known orthopedic surgeons who really specialize in these type of injuries. Again, we've had some, you know, we, Riz and I know over the years, some very technically skilled, very, very experienced surgeons who we would trust ourselves going to with surgery. And I think that's a combination of not only technical mastery, so just having the hands to do it, but knowledge of the literature, knowledge of anatomy, and then just the experience. So I could read as much as I want and I could practice as much as I want, but 2 years into practice, I'm not going to be as good as Dr. Warner or Dr. Gill or Dr. Andrews or Dr. Verma or whoever else is in the country. Hopefully you work your way up by continuing to keep up with the literature and doing more cases and practicing just like you would trying to hone your fastball or trying to hone your slider for placement. But it is true, there is a small subset of orthopedic surgeons who have really reached the pinnacle, and those are people who were taking care of you.
Yeah, I always felt very confident that I was in the best hands possible. I've gotten more and more over the years, just gotten more curious about how those doctors get to those positions. And you touched on it, some of the aspects that go into it. But yeah, how much does this like word of mouth and trust play into it? Because if it's like this superstar athlete had an injury and we went to this doctor and then came back stronger than ever, like that looks good on the surgeon, right? And like every other player is now like, I want to go to that guy. And then, you know, even though, let's just take a very simple surgery. I don't know if there's such a thing as simple surgeries, but a basic simple surgery that Dr. Johnson does, it's on a superstar athlete. And then, you know, Dr. Johnson now has the reputation of being an unbelievable surgeon where, you know, he's very good, but he may have just done something that many other people could have done, but you just continue to build a reputation of the guy that is good at these types of surgeries, right?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. We have a doc who used to work directly with us with the White Sox, but now he's older and more experienced and now really just fields surgical consults from the team. So if one of the players breaks their hand, they may call me to evaluate the player. They may bring the player to my clinic to be seen and look at x-rays, but they will likely take this player to this older, more experienced surgeon. I think that's probably the right thing to do. I take absolutely no offense to that. But he's been doing this for 30 years. He's an expert and I respect him. And once you get your name out there and you continue to provide good results and treat people well, then I think then you can rise in the ranks. And then of course, being a quote team doctor is a marketing tool in itself. So when someone finds out, oh, I'm going to the team doctor for the Cubs, or I'm going to the team doctor for the Arizona Cardinals, and you're either a weekend warrior with a rotator cuff injury, or you're a high school student who's torn their ACL, but oh, the Cardinals doctor, the Cubs doctor is doing my surgery. That means a lot for patient confidence and family confidence. But as the surgeon, you also have to back that up. So you have to be caring, be empathetic, be compassionate, be technically good, be up to date with the literature. So it's a two-way street. You can't just say, hey, I'm the Cubs doctor and mail it in. You have to deliver the results and be the top surgeon that you can be. Because not only are you operating on people like you, Danny, elite athletes, but you're operating on other just regular people and you have to treat everyone the same.
Yeah, that makes sense. I gained, when I had my surgeries, you know, had the, I knew who Dr. Andrews was just based off his reputation and felt very confident that he was the guy to go to. And, you know, all the other doctors and all those surgeons agreed as well. And, you know, I thought it was, talk about marketing and like a, not necessarily a bad sense, but at least the office that I went to for Dr. Andrews is just plastered with jerseys and autographs. That makes you feel so good going into it that you're in the best position you possibly can be. And I'm that probably, you know, that's years of hard work and getting guys healthy. And that's incredible. It's those little like techniques of building confidence and building comfort with their patients just went so far because there's just 50 of them in the office.
Yeah, it's about confidence as a professional pitcher. It's about confidence as a surgeon. It's about confidence, not about irrational confidence. It's about confidence built in a foundation of expertise, knowledge of the literature, knowledge of the anatomy, and also humility with knowledge that you know that you're not a god, that things can always go wrong during surgery. There are always problems and that you may not anticipate and you need multiple plans to back them up. And even if you're the best possible surgeon and you do the best job you can possibly do, you may not have a favorable outcome. So that humility, I think, is a part. And you talked about that with pitchers, that if you have a bad outing, you can't just ruin your life over one bad outing. You have to understand, yeah, I may be Danny Holtzen. I may be able to throw the ball 95 miles an hour and be best players in UVA history, but I'm human. I had a bad outing. It happens. And you have to just get back on your horse.
Yes, absolutely. I think, you know, connecting those dots a little bit, like those lessons that I learned as a player, like are applicable to everyone, right? Like that's actually something that we talk about with some of our guys is like, sometimes there's feeling of being on a pedestal because you play baseball and the problems you face are unique and special and you're the only one that's ever felt them and you're the only one that's dealt with them. When in reality, like they're all just human emotions that are brought out in baseball. And yeah, everything you just said, like doctors feel this, everybody feels this, like the same feeling you get when you have to give a presentation at school is very similar to the feelings you get pitching in front of thousands of people. It's, you know, you think the pitching in front of thousands of people is like special and unique. You know, in some sense it is just because not everybody gets to do it, but it's still the same feeling. It's still a human emotion of like excitedness and maybe a little anxious and a little whatever. But that's something that I learned through that. It's like, damn, like the lessons that I learned going through all of this is just everything that I all feel as a non-player and just a human, and just I'm going to learn how to deal with these off the field because I learned how to deal with them on the field.
Danny, appreciate it.
Yeah, of course. This was fun.
I'll add one final thing. Cam, you make a good point on humility. I think one of the other key points here is that no matter what you're doing, if it's rehabilitation, surgery, performance enhancements with your athletes, performance, being a performance coach, it's understanding that, again, you're human and that if something does go sideways, you acknowledge that and you learn how to get better, again, by, you said, being current in literature, being current in the events that are happening now, and understand that you're expressing that to the person you're dealing with, that, you know, this is the outcome we desire, but there is a percentage of this that could end up here, right? And I think that's a key point. I think exposure is one of the reasons why a lot of these surgeons become the go-to surgeon, right? Or physical therapist in the industry, is that it's the exposure of that athlete that got back to where they needed to be. And I think you pretty much hit it on the head, nail on the head.
Perfect, Danny. We've spent a lot of time talking about this kind of stuff, obviously off the mic, and I learned still so much from you.
Yeah.
So thanks for taking the time, buddy.
Of course. This is
Danny,
fun.
It was a pleasure. I'm glad I got the chance to meet you. Cam's talked you up a bunch.
Oh, good. More fluffing.
More fluffing.
At some point, we'll have to come out to Chicago. Cam and I will have to come out for a game.
Oh, hell yeah. That'd be great.
Cam will eat all the hot dogs.
No way.
And if the Cubs are winning, you stay in the same seats. And
that's right.
If we're losing,
and bananas and peanut butter? Like, what's
yeah,
that?
Right. All right. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, buddy.
Thanks for listening to Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast. Follow us on social media, watch full episodes on YouTube, and check out our website.
The information shared on this podcast is for educational and informational purposes only and is not intended as medical advice. Please consult a licensed healthcare provider for guidance related to your specific situation. We'll see you next week.